Today in Studio 360, nothing is quite as it seems.
I have a hangover that is a real museum piece.
Lee Israel was a best-selling biographer and a pro at digging up letters by famous writers like Dorothy Parker. But it turns out she was the one writing them.
The best of the hangover lines are hers. The rest are mine. I got 6 months house arrest, which is not so easy if you saw my apartment at the time.
And when we think of evil tyrants, we don't usually think marketing geniuses.
It was done through flags, it was done through banners, and ultimately it was done through spectacle.
Stephen Heller shows us how the 20th century's towering madmen were actually master branders. One of those tyrants, Mao Zedong, spent years writing dreamy romantic poetry.
The plum is not a delicious girl showing off, yet she heralds spring.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today we'll hear about how totalitarian governments used graphic design as a powerful form of propaganda. And later I'll talk with the unorthodox hip-hop artist Talib Kweli. But first, here's a letter I came across recently in a new collection signed by a literary favorite of mine, Dorothy Parker.
83 Norma Place, Hollywood, California. Dear Joshua, Alan told me to write and apologize. I'm doing that now while he dresses for turkey dinner with the boys across the road. I have a hangover that is a real museum piece. I'm sure that I must have said something terrible. To save me this kind of exertion in the future, I'm thinking of having little letters run off saying, "Can you ever forgive me, Dorothy?"
Dorothy Parker, however, did not write that letter. My guess, Lee Israel did.
Best of the hangover lines are hers. The rest are mine.
And in her new book, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, she tells the story of her years as a literary con artist, forging all kinds of letters by famous writers. So that isn't by Dorothy Parker at all.
Well, there's one line, the best line. Can you guess which it is? That's really Dorothy. I have a hangover that is a real museum piece.
So the title of your book is from this purported letter by Dorothy Parker, but it's a Lee Israel line.
Yes, I imagine Dorothy apologizing in her waif-like way for some misdeed. And I sat down and I wrote. It's in the spirit of kind of jeu d'esprit.
So how did you get the idea for this racket of forging famous people's letters and selling them to dealers?
Well, it was incremental, as most things are in life. I was in the library, where I spent most of my time foraging, and they gave me a group of letters, and I thought perhaps even one or two of those could pay for my kiddie's tests, and I shooed it. I took it, I walked out of the library, and I sold it. And I was told by the woman who bought my letters that, which I didn't know anything about the business, but she would pay more for better content. So I went home and I typed up some better content.
And then when you started forging after that instead of stealing, what was the first thing you forged?
Actually, I don't remember where I started. I have a feeling. Let me think. I know it wasn't Dorothy. I think the first things I forged were Noel Coward letters.
And you bought not just one, but a whole series of antique typewriters on which to do this.
Yeah,
work.
Well, finally, if I had Noel type on one typewriter and Dorothy on another and Edna Ferber on yet another, I had about six or seven of them in a locker I rented on Amsterdam Avenue. It looked like a very classy pawn shop.
That is pawn shop, not a porn shop.
Not a porn shop, yeah.
And it's amazing how little regulation there is. I mean, for instance, the Noel Coward letters, some of them were published in an anthology of his correspondence.
That's right, recently in a highly regarded, well-reviewed book called The Letters of Noel Coward. And there were two of my letters showed up in that volume.
Can we hear one of your Noel Coward letters?
Okay, I got to find it. All right, I just, Dear Kevin, Sunday, and at the letterhead is Les Avances sur Montreuse. pardon my French. Dear Kevin, I am who doesn't exist. I am feeling years younger having luge this morning over perfectly packed snow. There is no substitute for oxygen in the lungs. It seems to release something very like morphine. Marlene, as I perhaps mentioned to you when we spoke, was here for almost a week. She will never change, and to try to force her is folly. She moans endlessly about the ravages of aging, the betrayal of friends, the loneliness of celebrity. The silly old kraut addresses each of these problems as if she were the only beautiful and celebrated creature to experience reversals. I intend to have her in my life until one of us croaks, but she is possibly the most jejune grandmother in the history of our planet. It's a very good thing that I love her. I laughed uproariously at your dogged doggerel, yours ever, Noel.
It's Lee Israel's version of of Noel Coward.
And they were among the best letters, I think.
Of his?
Well, what? You know, I'll tell you why. Because he didn't have to be Noel Coward when he wrote letters. He was writing letters. I had to try hard. I had to be Noel Coward. And so they were cavorted, they camped, they jumped high, jeted around. I mean, he didn't write letters like that. I was doing it to please dealers and to do an imitation of this terrific man who didn't have to try to be Noel Coward.
How did you have to try to get into character? How much did you immerse yourself in their work? Did you put on a hat like they wore or poured yourself a drink? What did you do?
I never poured myself a drink because, who was it who said, John Cheever? That old womanizing alcoholic said, even a sip of sherry shows in his prose. So I never drink when I write. I immerse myself in that wonderful thing that happens to creative people, a kind of trance. The creative trance, it's as good as it gets.
Right. Now let's rewind. Before you ever got into this, you were a successful biographer.
When I was in my early 30s, I wrote a book about Dorothy Kilgallen. I wrote a book about Tallulah Bankhead. I did finally a book that wasn't so good about Estee Lauder. After the Lauder book, my lights dimmed a bit, and they stopped taking me to lunch.
And you were on welfare, and it was really rough.
It wasn't just terrible.
It wasn't just that you were no longer a bestseller.
What is rough? I mean, I wasn't eating roots in Niger, but
yeah.
In terms of my life, it was bad. It was I was alone. Yeah. She was alone.
And you had a sick cat as well.
I had a sick
to
cat.
Add to the romance of the whole thing. And how much did you get for that? Those first letters?
I think they're $40 a piece, something like that.
So it wasn't a lot of money per letter. I mean, $40.
$40 allowed me to take my cat to the vet and find out maybe what was wrong with her. It was enough to keep me, as I say, finally in lunch and cigarettes and rent. It was not a lot of money.
In terms of the letters you forged, apart from the marketability of a given author or figure, how did you choose who you wanted to do?
I've been thinking about that. I know that I have had certain criteria which had to be met. The signature mostly had to be doable, easy. So Edna, for instance, Edna Ferber or some Edna or Ferb, she signed her letters with a period. Very simple writing, no loops, no swirls, no jumps. Same thing, Knowles was, a little harder. Dorothy Parker had an easy signature. They had to present a challenge to me. They had to have literary, epistolary styles that I thought I could duplicate and have fun doing. And I guess those are the criteria.
Well, the have fun is interesting to me because they are also nearly all sort of soigné, naughty people of a certain period.
Yeah, and a certain habits with alcohol and of a certain age, which meant that if I shook a little in the signature, it wouldn't tell so much.
Uh-huh. But they would all, one would want to go to the cocktail party with most of these people.
Anyway. All of them, except maybe Edna Ferber.
I was going to say. how many letters did you write in all?
I think about 400.
Really?
Yeah, you can see that. You can see as we sit, there's a loose leaf with copies
of
everything.
So basically two or three a week for the 3 years, something like that.
I guess I didn't. You do the math. I did them whenever I needed to do them. There was one dealer in New Hampshire who would call and say, do you have something, Greta Garbo? Or have you something which George Cukor has mentioned? Now, I always satisfied his demands. Now, what did he think? I mean, really.
And what would you say? Yeah, maybe I do.
I have a feeling they may be in the country, you know, like I had a country home. I'll check. And I wasn't even smart enough to say, oh, no, I couldn't. I always, you know, it was $80, $90, $100. And it was the Noel Coward letters that finally done me in.
Yeah.
Because I overdid, and because one of his friends who was in the market to buy Noel Coward letters was shown some of mine and knew full well that Noel, having lived at a time when homosexuality was a jailing offense, never would have put so many campy, mm-hmm. funny allusions in his letters. And the stuff that's homoerotic, etc., I got from his diaries. But Noel would have been much too careful to disclose as I did. What happened finally is that once the man, the friend of Noel's, discerned that there was something rotten in Denmark, he told the dealer who told other dealers, and finally the well was toxic and I could no longer sell.
And then as soon as the federal agents showed themselves, they didn't arrest you immediately. You went off thinking you were going to get rid of the typewriters, destroy the evidence?
Got rid of everything I could get my hands on. I scissored everything. I took the typewriters from the locker one by one, and they were very heavy. You know, we're talking 1940s, 1950s. And I placed them up and down various trash receptacles on Amsterdam Avenue.
So you were finally nabbed, prosecuted, went to trial. You got off pretty easy.
I did. Well, I got 6 months house arrest, which is not so easy if you saw my apartment at the time.
Not only did you not go to jail, you have this lovely book that's come out that is getting good reviews and kind of kind attention. Nobody that I've seen seems to be saying, how dare this thief and forger get away with this.
I know, and I'm relieved, but I have a knowledge that what I did was wrong. But I don't feel that in the pit of my stomach. The bloggers are not being so kind.
That's what bloggers do.
I know. One of them called me a twit, and I hope he spelled it right. Somebody else called me an intellectual terrorist. I mean, so that happens. But mostly the community of writers and, no, not so much scholars, of writers and peers are liking it and are being very kind to me and non-judgmental. I know what I did was wrong. Honest, Your Honor.
Lee Israel, I want to thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Lee Israel's book, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, is available now. Coming up, branding, police state style.
Gregari di tutte le forze armate dello Stato.
You know, you think the skateboarders invented stenciling on walls, but they didn't. It was Duce. It was Mussolini who knew that his face should be on every building to remind the populace that this was the guy. This was their man, their big brother.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by The Dial Press, publisher of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, a novel by Marianne Schaffer and Annie Barrows that People magazine calls poignant and keenly observed, about love, war, and the immeasurable substance to be found in good books.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. At this point, the design historian Stephen Heller has literally written more books than most people have read. But his latest one is his magnum opus. It's called Iron Fists. It is a big, richly illustrated book with an elegant thesis about the great horrors of the 20th century, that the four big totalitarian states, Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, Soviet Russia, and Maoist China, were all expertly branded by their leaders. Steve Heller, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be here.
So Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, Mao, what made these evil guys such expert branders?
Well, at the top of that list is the Nazis. They weren't the first, but they did it the best. And what they created was an identity around two things. One is their trade character, or what I call a trade character, Adolf Hitler, and the other is their trademark, the swastika.
Now trade character is a term of art in the branding world for Mr. Clean and Bob's Big Boy and
the Frida Bandito.
Some people might be offended that you're suggesting these guys like Mao and Hitler are equivalent.
Well, they are, because what you see is their face, and that visage becomes a symbol. In addition to being a human being, it is a mark of an ideology. It's a mark of a regime. It's a mark of a religion.
And as you say, the swastika even more was a kind of brilliant adoption by Hitler himself early on of this age-old symbol.
He was actually quite jealous of the Soviets. He wanted a hammer and sickle of his own. He wanted a red flag of his own. And so he developed something. He developed a brand that was memorable and caused great pride, allowed for people, enabled people to be proud of the nation and proud of the party.
And you quote him talking in Mein Kampf about the importance of this kind of thinking for a movement.
It was very key. He realized that people needed affiliations, and they needed physical affiliations, concrete affiliations, and that was done through badges. I mean, he called his logo a badge. It was done through flags. It was done through banners. And ultimately, it was done through spectacle. So it wasn't just the two-dimensional graphics. It was three-dimensional graphics. It was stagecraft.
The Nuremberg rallies and the lights, of which we've seen only glimpses in Leni Riefenstahl.
Right, and ultimately the architecture. The architecture for Hitler, Hitler wanted to be an architect. Goebbels kept saying, Hitler is an artist who saved the nation, and once the nation was totally saved, he would be an artist again. What's interesting, and with all of these dictators, save for Lenin, they all had aspirations towards art in some fashion. Mussolini was a writer. He was a novelist, a published novelist. The Cardinal's Mistress was his book. Mao was one of the great calligraphers, and that was because he understood the power of the graphic.
Do you remember the first time that these symbols and these graphic schemes grabbed you?
I went briefly to a military school, so I was kind of into that regalia. And indeed, it is something. It is a tonic.
What do you mean it's a tonic?
Well, when you earn and wear the medals, the patches, the insignia, you feel like you're part of something. You feel like you're in a tribe. And that's what all branders try to do. They try to make tribes out of people, loyal consumers of their particular product or ideology. So I was seduced in that way. But the first time I was ever struck by the power of these things, the negative power, was when I was going through my grandmother's drawer one day and came across a postcard that was returned to her after the war. And it was stamped with these swastikas and symbols of Grosse Deutschland, the eagle. And they just kind of took my breath away and gave me a pit in my stomach.
Some of the early Nazi graphics that you have in the book are modern and gorgeous. And when I look at them and feel, this is beautiful, I feel guilty and wrong for having that perception. Did you go through that as you went through this trove of stuff?
Definitely. At first, I didn't want to collect this material. For years, as much as it appealed to me, I passed by the dealers, the offerings, the resources that I would need to create a book like this. And finally, I just gave in, and I felt guilty every time I acquired an object. But I also felt this elation every time I found an object that I had never seen before. And I was buying things from some strange people. And realized,
who may or may not be sympathizers.
Who may or may not be suspect. Now, I also took great pleasure in buying Italian fascist material because there was such a beauty to it. The Nazi stuff is striking. It's strong. It's strident. But the Italian fascist was kind of Mediterranean dictator. You know, it was beautiful colors, soothing typefaces. There was a whole different aesthetic and a whole different gestalt for these images until the war began, and then all propaganda changes.
In talking about the Italian fascist graphics, you call it carnivalesque. Give me an example or two of what you mean by that.
In Italy, to capture the youth, or the flowers of youth, as they were called, they created graphics that were youth-oriented. They were based on comics. They were based on cartoons. They were colorful. They were lighthearted. They were carnivalesque. And that was something that these kids could respond to. And at the same time, they promoted the wearing of particular uniforms and badges, and not unlike the Boy Scouts of America. I hope no lightning bolt hits me, but that's what these things were. They were these Boy Scout groups that taught these kids to be ideological soldiers.
We have a song from 1936, Fascist Italy. Let's listen to that.
Verso Roma passo militare, oggi tutta Italia marcerà.
Vuol veder il condottiere,
il nostro amato duce vuole ognuno ringraziar.
La champion, ai vincitor,
ai fanti vittoriosi d'oltremar.
So that's propaganda music, but certainly carnivalesque. You can imagine the Looney Tune of which that's the soundtrack.
You can, but you can also detect, even if you can't speak Italian, the word duce. And duce was the leader.
It was Mussolini.
Benito Mussolini, and he was omnipresent. You hear that over and over again. It becomes melodic. It becomes a cadence. Duce, duce, duce. And that's all part of the branding.
Graphically, they used his face, his silhouette, in a way, based on the evidence of your book, more than anybody else's.
You know, you think the skateboarders invented stenciling on walls, but they didn't. It was Duce. It was Mussolini who knew that his face should be on every building to remind the populace that this was the guy. This was their man, their big brother.
The fact that his image was so abstracted and immediately recognizable in this highly abstracted form really does suggest, as you say, that these people, in his case especially, became these like trade characters where, that's Alki Alka-Seltzer. That's, Pillsbury Doughboy. Oh, it's Mussolini. I mean, it's to that degree of kind of instant recognizability.
Totally. And his son-in-law, Count Ciano, who was at one time responsible for propaganda in the Italian state, said that Mussolini was more interested in the myth of fascism than the reality, that he was more interested in the way he looked and the way his followers looked than the actual policy. And so the policy became the myth. It was a complex absorption. I mean, it was narcissism on the highest level, but it was also charisma that came out of that narcissism.
So you're almost suggesting that Italian fascism was a giant art project of which the ideology was just tacked on to justify.
Ultimately, I'd say it was, tragically so. I mean, if it was kept as an art project, it would have been nice in a gallery instead of in terms of a nation. But many of these things, and Hitler was the same way. I mean, Hitler was an artist at heart who saw politics as a tool of his art.
Well, and you start the book with a very prescient Walter Benjamin quote about fascism being essentially that.
Fascism is the aestheticization of politics. It's a brilliant line. And these dictatorships managed to embrace that and use that better than anybody else. In democracies, you just don't seem to have that because you cannot set those rules. I mean, even in the United States, there's no real law about the use of the American flag. Anybody can have it. Anybody can use it. Anybody can use the red, white, and blue in any which way. But there were rules about how these brands could be used by the populace.
Although apparently we've discovered that if you're running for president, you have to have a flag pin. That's a rule. And that was an unwritten rule.
An unwritten rule, but we'll see where that goes.
One wonders, I was just in Beijing and I saw all these fantastic new buildings that they've commissioned, and I felt my heart in mind, softening to the Chinese regime. Oh, look, this Rem Koolhaas building. Oh, look, Steve Hull has built this great building there. It is soft power of at least a kind of analogous kind.
It is. It's a different kind of propaganda for a different purpose. It's not the hard-edged ideology that propaganda was trying to embrace when Mao was forging the Cultural Revolution, in part because Mao thought his power had been usurped. And he, in fact, literally gave up his power, so he wanted it back. So it was all about power. This is about power in a different way. This is about economic power. This is about showing the world that they can rise above the old communist strictures.
Obviously, the Nazis and Mussolini, both fascists, China and the Soviet Union, both communists. But there are clearly broad differences in all kinds of ways. Did you find any striking differences one to the next?
What I found that was striking was Germany's use of modernism, even though they called it cultural Bolshevism. What I found in Italy was they embraced modernism. But this was all opportunistic stuff. The Germans used modernism in their architecture and in some of their graphics when it suited them, when they needed it. And I find that that was a similarity in those two fascist regimes, one totally anti-modernist and the other embracing modernism until it no longer worked for them. In terms of the Chinese model, it was all based on the Soviet socialist realism, and it was based to a certain extent on folk arts. They tried to integrate a little bit of folk art with their Soviet-style propaganda.
Which is to say, sort of highly realistic, kitschy pictures of heroic workers and soldiers fighting the aggressor or looking toward the sky and the future.
Right. It was all romanticized. You know, sometimes Mao smiled, sometimes he didn't. By the way, Mao never brushed his teeth. But in the posters, when he's smiling, you see white teeth. If you were to see a photograph of him, you'd see black. So these were posters like advertising posters, like those great images you see on Mad Men that were meant to make the American woman and the American male look heroic. I mean, that's what this was doing for their trade character.
Stephen Heller, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Steve Heller's new book is called Iron Fists, and you can see images from it at studio360.org. Stephen Heller mentioned Mao Zedong's great skill as a calligrapher, and it turns out that this man, otherwise responsible for mass death and misery, had a rich creative life beyond calligraphy. As Sarah Campbell tells us, Mao loved writing poetry, too.
Not surprisingly, many of Mao's poems are war poems. Some of them were written during years when he lived out of a cave. They're about the military struggles of his early career, like the Red Army's 6,000-mile long march of 1934. So can we learn about Chinese history from Mao's poetry?
Well, if you want to know the history of the 20th century and the wars, it certainly is helpful.
That's Mao scholar and translator Willis Barnstone.
But I think what the poems show more than anything else is not only their very, very frequent beauty and use of language in an extremely concise, typically Chinese, concise and evocative way.
Okay, so Mao wrote beautiful poetry? Let's listen to one of his poems. It's a nature poem. He wrote a lot of those, too.
风雨送春归,飞雪迎春到,已是悬崖百丈冰,犹有花枝俏. Spring disappears with rain and wind and comes with flying snow. Ice hangs on 1,000 feet of cliff, yet at the tip of the topmost branch, the plum blooms. The plum is not a delicious girl showing off, yet she heralds spring. When mountain flowers are in wild bloom, she giggles in awe the color.
To me, those images don't seem so extraordinary.
That's Rachel Aviv. She wrote recently about Mao's poetry in relationship to his politics.
I'm not sure that his poetry stands alone. I think it's impressive technically, but it doesn't strike me as particularly original.
For Aviv, what's remarkable is not the fact that Mao mastered conventional Chinese verse, but the fact that his own poetry does not sound like the type of Marxist writing he called for.
In the Yenin talks, his talks about literature and art in 1949, he wrote that we must fit art and literature properly.
We must fit art and literature properly into the whole revolutionary machine. Art should be a powerful weapon for uniting and educating the people and for attacking and annihilating the enemy.
To have a poem about plum blossoms, it seems sort of absurd to put that in the context of a poem being a powerful weapon for revolution.
Mao's poems, as you heard, are often modeled after classical Chinese nature poetry. His language is refined, and the poems are loaded with mythical allusions. But he wanted everyone else in China to write in common speech and to avoid the old forms. He said the old style would cramp their thought. He even at one point told younger writers not to use his poetry as a model.
Mao permitted this formal kind of poetry with references to traditional poetry only to himself during his main years. He said he was too old in a kind of uncertain modesty to write in any other way. However, other people could not do this. They had to do a kind of unfriendly social realism. It's almost a kind of madness.
This madness produced a lot of poetry. During the Great Leap Forward in the late 50s, China decided that poems could be mass-produced the same way other national goods were. So, to boost literary production, poem collectors were dispatched into factories and farms. They were supposed to gather poems and songs from the workers while they worked the machines. The results? Well, here's an example.
Each year, our farm production rose. Grains and cotton pile up mountain high. Hurrah! Eat the grains, but don't forget the sower. The Communist Party is our dear ma and pa.
On the one hand, this Great Leap Forward approach to poetry was a success. More poems were definitely getting churned out, but most of what was written lacked, shall we say, substance. In that sense, making tons of poems failed in the same way that the efforts to produce tons of steel and grain failed. In the years that followed, the Chinese people suffered what may be the largest famine in human history.
He presented his ideas about art with such force and rage that to see him then create a piece of art that looks sort of romantic and sensual and conventional, it makes it seem like a much greater contradiction.
Ultimately, Mao will not be remembered for his images of plum blossoms, but for the way his policies ended up attacking and annihilating not just the enemy, but his own people.
That's Sarah Campbell. A version of this story was first produced for the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast. China today is not quite free and not quite a democracy, but it has nowhere near the nightmarish tyranny or hermetic self-secrecy of North Korea. I am slightly obsessed with the place, partly because we know so little about it. And I wondered, what kind of aesthetic propaganda do its old-school totalitarians use? Guy Delisle knows a little bit more about that than the rest of us.
I was there in Pyongyang in 2001. I was actually supervising work for animation, a French animation studio.
Delisle is a cartoonist and illustrator who happened to live in the capital, Pyongyang, for a few months doing animation work. He turned that experience into a riveting graphic memoir called Pyongyang.
I was there before September 11, which makes a big difference because after that it became like the bad guys. So actually nobody was going there. But I was thinking, if I go to Pyongyang, that's going to be interesting to do a diary about that. Because I always go, I take notes, and then when I come back, I decide if I do a book or not. At the airport, there was no light. It was all dark. So I can only see silhouettes. So I thought, wow, that's they don't have a lot of energy here, if even the airport is dark. But then you see lots of details, and they all have these pins on them, this little image of either Kim Jong-il, Kim Il-sung, or both of them. So at one point I realized, wow, it's everybody's wearing that same small image of the leader. everybody's wearing that badge. And on top of that, you have all of the paintings in the walls that represent the dear leader visiting some factory, guiding the people. So that's more of the Russian type of happy socialism life. And then you have the flowers, and then they explain you that there's the Kim Jong-il flower and there's the Kim Il-sung flower. The one is red, one is white. And then you realize it's full of that everywhere. And you see, okay, this is the great leader, this is the other one. In one day, I was trying to count like the numbers of representation, propaganda image you have, and it's like more than 50. It's on your face all the time. It's just crazy. There's no way you can come out of that in a lifetime without being brainwashed, because we were listening to the radio and all the songs, at one point, you have Kim Jong-il or Kim Il-sung in it. And every song. So after 2 months, you realize that this is, it's not just a country, it's like a sect, because everybody has that image. And they all do exercise, and they all train for parades for the great leader. And you, after 2 months, you realize that it's so strange, and you really feel the weight they have on their shoulder to believe what they've been told without having no other sources of information. They're all mad at the book, of course, which I can understand, but for two reasons. My translator is probably afraid that I can put words in their mouth that gonna jeopardize them. And for them, it means, you know, it can be very serious trouble. The head of the department, well, the big chief of the company is probably mad because I give a bad image of the country. But frankly, I don't see how I can give a good image of the country.
DeLille is a cartoonist and the author of Pyongyang. And I guess he sort of specializes in East Asian dictatorships. His new graphic memoir, The Burma Chronicles, comes out later this month. Yeah. Coming up, rapper Talib Kweli is one of the hottest artists in hip-hop, but it wasn't always that way.
I saw KRS-One, and at 15 years old, these are people who were just celluloid to me. I could never imagine that I would be standing next to them in person, just with a camera and a raincoat, like,
nerd.
Take a picture, yeah, exactly.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
PRI's Studio 360 is supported by DK Eyewitness Travel, publisher of guides to hundreds of destinations around the world. Now available wherever books are sold. DK Eyewitness Travel, showing what others only tell. Information at traveldk.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The candidacy of Barack Obama means, inevitably, that hip-hop artists are entering the political fray as never before, for better or worse.
The question is America ready for a president who seems to embrace hip-hop music?
I'll usually vote. Matter of fact, folks who don't usually vote, they usually quote me as a source of information.
One of the rappers going political this year is Brooklyn MC Talib Kweli. Before this election, Kweli had made sort of a point of abstaining from electoral politics. But that hasn't meant his music isn't politically engaged. His latest record, Eardrum, is full of socially conscious lyrics, and it opens with the Langston Hughes poem, A Dream Deferred. I talked to him about it when it came out last year.
Well, you know, just to connect, you know, young listeners with, like, the canon of black literature, I always open up like that. And that poem is very relevant, you know, like a lot of Langston Hughes stuff is. It's timeless and it remains relevant.
Mm-hmm. A lot of your songs are grounded in the borough of your birth, where you still live. What was it like growing up in Brooklyn in the 80s, I guess?
It was great. I mean, you know, you write about that. My music is, my chief influences are Brooklyn and my parents. And you know, and the situations that I was placed in. You know, the kids in my neighborhood in Flatbush, they were just standing on a corner. And there was always a group of us, two or three of us, who would be like, okay, well, we're going to actually get on the train and go to the city. And, you know, Washington Square Park around that time was pre-Giuliani time, and it was sort of like an arts festival, especially in the summertime. You had magicians, you had people performing Shakespeare, juggling, you know, and us freestyling fit right into the novelty of it all. And it's like we would freestyle and get crowds of people around us. And
so as a teenager, really, or certainly as a young man, you burst on the scene in the late 90s as half of Black Star, your sort of underground duo with Mos Def. How did you and Mos Def hook up?
Mos Def, who was acting already, you know, he used to come through the park and hang out.
And then you got together and said, hey, let's make a record together?
Yeah, years later, when he had put out a couple records, he was touring with De La Soul, and I was working at the bookstore. I was just a fan of his. I gave him my demo tape just as a fan, like, here, my name is Kweli, check this out. And, you know, our paths were just aligned. You know, we were two MCs from Brooklyn who had kids the same age who were rapping, kicking rap songs at poetry readings.
Let's before we talk some more, let's listen to a track from that album with Mos Def.
It's a paradox we call reality. So keeping it real will make you a casualty of abnormal normality. Killers born naturally like Mickey and Mallory. Not knowing the ways will get you capped like an NBA salary. So cast BMC and to illustrate what we be seeing. Hard to be a spiritual being, wishing to shake in what you believe in. The trees to grow in Brooklyn, seeds need to be planted. I'm asking if y'all feel me, and the crowd left me stranded. My blood pressure boiled and rose. These New York niggas act to spoil their shows. To the winners, the spoils go. I take the L, transfer to the two, head to the gates. New York life type trife, the Roman Empire state.
So much on my mind, I just can't recline. Bless the holes in the night till she bless sunshine. Breathe in and hail vapors from bright stars to shine. Breathe out.
Now, that song that you did with Mos Def gives a great sense of how you pack in the allusions and cultural references. I mean, the Oliver Stone movie, the Tree Grows in Brooklyn, all this New York subway references, this great phrase, the Roman Empire State. What's that about?
That song is just dealing with the idea of the city breathing and like a living organism. New York, Common is on that record as well. He's from Chicago, which is a similar type of city. And sometimes at night, you know, when you're in the city, there's so much life, you can feel it sort of pulsating.
Hip-hop in general, at its best, does a lot to express that visceral urban sense, doesn't it?
That's what's great about good art, is it takes its lead from what's actually happening.
Uh-huh. Let's break down a track from your new album. It's called Country Cousins.
Yo,
Country Cousins.
Growing up in Brooklyn, yeah, I thought that everybody talked this way. Raised on Rakim and Run DMC, so I thought that everybody walked this way. We fresh, we chill, we deaf, we ill. It's just some things I was taught to say. Every Saturday morning, I watch cartoons with a bowl of frosted flakes. That the puberty came, started hitting them cuties with game, and the truancy came. Started cutting and not just class, I was coming off fast, I was new to the game. Music playing on TV, courtesy of Video Music Box Plus. Knew a lot of hustlers going OT, coming back with a new hip hop light. E40 holding
again, that's Country Cousins from your new album. It, absolutely stuffed with like five allusions per 2 seconds. I hear your music and it seems wittier and kind of has a lighter touch than a lot of hip-hop. Do you agree?
You know, I think my music, the aggressiveness of my music is not in posing or posturing. It's in the thoughts and the ideas. So it's not a lot of over aggression, I guess.
You're not playing a big character version of yourself.
Yeah, there's no need. I think this subject matter is strong enough.
Yeah. And how do you come up with lyrics? I mean, are you rhyming in your head? Are you thinking of lyrics?
Images pop in your head and things to rhyme about come in your head. But more recently, it's been the tracks. Like a track like that, you know, it started to make me think about growing up. And then I started talking about, you know, a big thing in hip-hop right now is how regional it is and how, you know, down south artists are way more successful right now. And I think there are things about New York hip-hop that we're not being honest about. You know, we never paid attention to any of this. And
because this was the place it began.
Exactly.
Why paying attention to those outposts?
Exactly. So we've been very arrogant about it. And in the meantime, what we forced them to do is support each other and build up their own networks. And they started selling CDs out of their trunks. And fast forward 10 years later, now they're way more successful. And the music is a different type of culture. It's a celebration, strip club culture, a lot of times with songs from down south. And it's like, that's what it's really about. Whereas in New York, we've been so focused on the art of it that we've been missing the paycheck.
As you're making these songs, how do you choose what you're going to sample?
I really, to be honest with you, when I pick beats, I'm not looking for samples.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking for things that are original. But I'm such a fan of old music that when I hear a beat that has a sample in it, it's just, I don't know. Like, I'm just drawn to it. And it becomes a problem. It becomes such a problem that I have to push my album release date back because the label's like, we have to clear all these samples.
Let's listen to a bit of an old soul tune that you sampled.
Fred Williams.
As you say, that is Fred Williams, a song called Tell Her by Fred Williams and the Jewels Band.
You want to hear something funny? I just added that to my set today. I came from rehearsal. I said, you know what, before we perform Listen, we're going to play this Tell Her.
Synchronicity.
Yeah.
Let's hear how you loop the beat on your first single, Listen.
This the year the blacksmith. Talib Kweli. Kweli. K-1.
Let's go.
Yeah. Back in the days we all used to
listen.
Now they're so whack, nobody
listen
to that real hip hop. Yo, ladies and gentlemen, get ready, here come Talib Kweli, and I'm banging on your eardrum. Now let me get up in it. Wait, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Stop repenting, cause the ending is near. But
there's the Romans thing again.
This Roman civilization we're living in right now.
There you go. So tell me how your creative process works in that case, how this Fred Williams tune gets folded into your song, Listen.
Well, there's a producer named Kwame who's a rap artist. He had a few records out back in the days, and he produced it, and he called me up, and he said, I want you to rap on this. You know, he did a very good job. There are producers who just loop songs, and then producers who chop beats and take certain elements of the track. He took the guitar lick, doom, doom, that comes in after, wait just a minute, and it doom, doom, and he made that the basis of my song. So that one guitar lick is the basis of my actual track. It took me even a minute, even though I listened to that song today, when you played it just now, it took me a minute to realize, I don't even know which parts he took, but it wasn't just a straight loop where it's like you recognize it.
It's more integrated.
Yes.
You have rapped about and talked about how there ought to be more rap songs with less misogyny, less celebrations of violence, less foul language, shallow verses than there are in lots of commercial hip hop. Is that a main way that you see your music is different?
Yeah. When I do that, when I'm critical of the art form, I do it within the art form.
Mm-hmm.
And I make the songs that can be the examples for how we can do it. I try not to be too critical of artists expressing themselves, but I try to express myself and to show the balance. So there's a different way we can do it.
And it's not all one thing or the other for you. You, for instance, you've said you're going to try to reduce the use of the N-word in your songs, but not take the abstinence pledge.
Right. It's not the artist's job to be politically correct or morally upstanding. It's uh-huh. the artist's job to be honest with how they express themselves. And sometimes an artist being less moral makes them a better artist. And that's the messed up thing about art, is that sometimes you can have real jerks create great art, and you just got to deal with it.
Thinking about the use of the N-word, a phrase I hate to say.
Mm-hmm. I hate the phrase, too.
In 10 years, in 20 years, in 30 years, do you think its use or its connotations or its frequency will change, or did it just start 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and this is how it's going to be? What do you foresee?
I think as we gain more information, the problem seems bigger than what it is. I don't think black people use the word any more or less now in 2007 than we used it in 1937.
Really?
Yeah, I just think that now through the internet and through hip-hop being so big culturally.
The Rock has been turned over.
Right. So now it's like, oh, my God, this is a problem. What is all this uproar over the language? There's 100 things to have an uproar over, you know, and it's like, okay, so if we stop saying it, are our communities going to be better fruit in the neighborhood grocery store? I don't understand.
Talib Kweli, thanks very much for coming into Studio 360.
Thank you.
You left me.
Yes. Welcome to the wonderful sounds of Talib Kweli. Ladies, I got you in the mood. For interlude, roar like in the nude. I hope this ain't considered rude, but let's stop talking because it's feeling like an interview. I know you're into me, so let me get into you.
Talib Kweli's latest album is called Eardrum, and a live concert DVD will be available at the end of the month. Last week on the show, we heard a story about the biologist Bernie Krause. He was the guy who has a theory about animals, that they communicate with each other on their own special frequencies, and that all those frequencies taken together interact as a kind of symphony orchestra. As part of his research, he's recorded tens of thousands of hours of nature sounds, including this one. We asked you to tell us what it was. Somebody thought it was a rat. Somebody else thought it was a grasshopper. One guy suggested it was the sound of a couple of fruit bats roosting. In fact, the answer is...
Answer easy to record. Take a lavalier mic and lay it over the entrance hole of an anthill, preferably carpenter ants, although many species will sing. A sunny, warm day helps. Turn on your recorder and listen.
Carpenter ants. Kudos to Dustin O'Neill of New York City and his remarkably nature-savvy ears. And that is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll be listening again next week. If you would like to subscribe to our weekly newsletter or our free weekly podcast, go to studio360.org. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Catherine Epstein,
Jill Dubois,
Aaron Davis.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
There's a tiny door in my office, Maxine, and it takes you inside John Malkovich.
You know, nobody in their right mind would do that film. I mean, make it about somebody else, you know, make it being, you know, whoever.
Getting inside John Malkovich, for real, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.